Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina. Today is May 31st, 2012. Happy end of the month, and thank you for listening to our very free, informative broadcast about health freedom. You can become part of this educational movement by telling your friends to listen to the show, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, any other social networks that you may know about. And you can also copy the embed code for any of the individual shows or episodes and put it on your favorite website or blog. You can become a regular listener by clicking that reminder button, and therefore you will get an email notice in your inbox to let you know that Debbie and Alan and also Greg Glazer from California, constitutional lawyer, he joins us every so often. That's once a month, and talks about health freedom too. So we're going to get involved in, I don't know what topics Alan has ready for us, but it's always very controversial. I'll say that.
Good word for it, Debbie. How are you doing today?
Okay, I'm doing great. And don't forget to visit Alan's web page, pandemicresponseproject.com.
And vaccinerights.com.
And vaccinerights.com. That's right. We need to keep that free.
Well, Debbie, I thought I'd go a little more political than we usually do today because there's some very interesting things going on, and we'll try to catch some current news items in the vaccine world as well, see how the time allows as we play out here. But I thought I'd ask if we could talk about, you know, you had sent to me just very recently a link to a blog of yours about CAM, complementary and alternative medicine,
yes,
in a free society. And I thought, with your permission, we could start with that and talk about what's going on here. I believe this was looking at some very disturbing things playing out in England, and part of that at least appeared to be an attack on homeopathy. Is that something you could shed some light on for us?
Okay, so you want me to talk about this. First of all, I'd like folks to know that they can find this blog by going to Homeopathy World Community. There is a banner at the top center of the page that says May 29th, 2012, we talked with Ellen Kramer. She is a homeopath and principal of the School of Homeopathy in the UK, the college actually, and she spoke with us about this issue. So you can hear another radio show too. And basically, there is a petition out there done by AVAAZ, which says that your access to homeopathy is under threat. And in my mind, I don't know how much these petitions do anything at all. But if you are living in the UK, if you're British, and you can go to the website and say something to your MP, to your representative in the parliament, to tell them that you would like them to take a particular look at the Medicines Act of 1968, which is being revamped and renamed to the Medicines Act Consolidation 2012. So basically, they're taking an old act that regulated the medicines and how they were being distributed and given, by the medical practitioners, homeopaths, and other practitioners to the general population, and they're going to consolidate all, I'm not exactly sure how or what, all of this information. And there's one key thing that on, let me see if I can find it, in section number 10, they were requesting a small change, that we allow greater freedom to dispense the remedies from the practitioners and also to overcome what we're considering an obstacle to getting the remedies, because they're saying that practitioners will only be able to dispense 100 remedies that have been designated as licensed. All the rest of them, the thousands of homeopathic remedies, they're saying are not licensed. And those are the ones that people won't be able to get and practitioners won't be able to dispense. The only way is for the patient or the general population to walk into a pharmacy, talk to the pharmacist, and get a prescription and have him hand it over to them at that time, which is totally impractical because there are only a small number of pharmacies in the entire country, which makes it impossible for people to get them, to get there in terms of proximity and traveling and getting there. And can you imagine if you couldn't get the remedy and then they were not going to even allow it for you to order it online? You couldn't go to a catalog online and order it? And, you know, it's just going way beyond the point of sanity, of freedom, of your rights to choose and to be able to go to your healthcare provider and get what you need to heal. So I just went on and on about that. I hope it makes, was it clear at all?
Absolutely, Debbie, and thank you for taking the time to explain that. And I want to take a very, hopefully, brief moment to say that while this is a show primarily focused on vaccines and your rights in the U.S., that we often talk about what's going on around the world in vaccine issues, because the healthcare arena is something where we see general trends that have similarities around the world, even though the very particular events, the very particular political structures and legal systems vary from country to country. The healthcare, broader healthcare issues are often international issues. And as you have even said to me, Debbie, recently, that things that go on in one country often foreshadow what's going to happen in another country or follow what's happened in another country. And so it really is important to us, and I think very helpful to us, to, first of all, even in the vaccine issue, to have not only the international perspective, but to look at what's going on broader beyond just vaccines, because vaccines, while it's a huge issue unto itself, and that being a reason why we have a show focused primarily on vaccines and vaccine legal rights in the U.S., it's very closely related, I believe, to broader issues going on, and this is a relevant one. We see things going on in Europe and other parts of the world regarding access to alternative treatments, to vitamins and herbs and natural medicines and so forth. At the same time, and I think as another part of the same puzzle, that we see increase number in vaccines being recommended, required, or promoted, and access, in the case of the U.S. where vaccines are mandated, access to exemptions being limited. But I wanted to ask you a quick question, if I could, Debbie, just for a little clarification on my part, because I've studied a little tiny bit of homeopathy. And so I don't pretend, so I have some familiarity with the basic concepts, but I don't pretend to have any in-depth knowledge, and don't, about homeopathy from, say, the perspective of a practitioner, or really even from the perspective of someone who is a regular user of homeopathy over time, although I certainly have and keep homeopathic remedies in my home to use as and when needed. But you say you made reference to 100 being remedies that would remain readily accessible, but of course there are thousands of potential remedies that somebody might need or want. Do you have any sense of what would be typical from a practitioner's point of view? How many remedies might a typical, and I'm sure this varies, but if you could give us any sort of sense, how many remedies might a typical practitioner have on hand in their office to dispense as needed as they're seeing patients? Or how many remedies, of those maybe thousands that would not be readily available, how frequent and how often are people going to want or need those, or are practitioners going to be frustrated if this sort of thing goes through, in that they wouldn't be able to just turn around and hand it to them or direct them to a source where they could simply and quickly and easily get it?
Right. Well, first of all, I don't know what the top 100 remedies that have been recognized as licensed are, but I would say that there is a good proportion of homeopaths that do use a limited number of homeopathic remedies, which would fall into the category of these 100. But Ellen Kramer was saying very often we use remedies that are clearing a block for the remedy to actually work. Those might be called nosodes. And I do not think that the nosodes are within the category of the 100 licensed remedies. And these are very often used. Homeopathic remedies for people who have particular symptoms or particular diseases that require these types of remedies. There are practitioners who practice many methods that require remedies outside of the typical ones. For instance, we know that women use sepia for all kinds of female problems. But there are other sea animals, sepia is the cuttlefish, there are other sea animals that are very closely related to the sepia cuttlefish that could be used, like murex. And in these cases, that would be outside of the regulated, licensed, select remedy that would be best matching the energy of that individual. So I would say that a homeopath relies upon being able to source their remedies from the pharmacy when needed for each individual case and patient. And that would be the problem, because even if they gave a prescription and said, yes, you need to get the Murex, and they handed the patient or the client a prescription, that person would have to then go to the pharmacy. They couldn't just order it. They would have to walk in the door and speak to the pharmacist and then get a prescription or an okay from the pharmacist to release that drug, which it makes no sense, because the person who's caring for the individual is their practitioner.
Right. It's the old the bureaucrat in a desk, to use an analogy, the bureaucrat in the desk, sitting at a desk knows more about your child's needs than your child's pediatrician. You know, shouldn't the pediatrician and the parent have the discussion about whether the child needs or gets a vaccine or a treatment, and not somebody in office, in political office, in an office and also political office at a desk somewhere deciding, you know, what is or isn't mandated for everybody. And it's just, it really makes no sense. Unless, of course, you're in a position of wanting to dominate the healthcare market and you find these pesky, annoying people who prescribe things that actually cure and heal out of the way, so you can maximize your profits with pharmaceutical solutions, if that's even a fair word, to, you know, manage the issue. But yes, from a humanistic point of view, it makes no sense. And even if there were 100 remedies that were used 90% of the time, which I rather doubt based on what I've just heard you say, as there would be even entire categories such as nosodes that would not be available, or not readily available at any rate, it would be I mean, it just seems sort of arbitrary. I mean, either the system is acknowledged as one that people are allowed to access and utilize or not. Not that I'm suggesting that we should consider not disallowing people access to homeopathic treatment at all, but to sort of subdivide arbitrarily and say, well, here's 100 remedies that are okay, but the rest of them you have to go through extra steps. Because homeopathy in particular, as probably listeners on this show know, we're dealing with extreme dilutions, and so it's not like you're trying to regulate potentially highly poisonous medications. It just doesn't seem to make sense. Well, let's certainly, if there's anything else you want to say to folks about that, Debbie, or in summarizing it, please do so, and let's move on to some other topics after that.
Right. Well, what we want to do is inform people that slowly rights are being whittled away and that we need to take some action to speak out, be heard, let those who are doing the regulating know that we should have free access to what is needed, and practitioners should be able to dispense as needed, and that you can go to the AVES at the, I don't know how to pronounce that one, AVES, A-V-A-A-Z, and click the petition, but also to call or contact, email, any way you can, the people who are in the parliament representing the people, and let them know that even if you don't live in the UK, but you're outside the UK, you're concerned that this is going to make a difference in the lives of the citizens of that country. So that's really what we want to tell people. There's something, can I speak for a person who is, he says that he is blogging about against the real purpose of this person's blog is to be a counterbalance, he says, to misinformation. He calls what homeopaths publish misinformation distributed by UK homeopaths and their supporters. Would it be worthy to tell you what he says?
Sure.
He says that when I spoke with Ellen, she didn't give the full facts, and he said neither does the petition. The reality, he says, is that the future threat is actually the current position in law and has been for a long time. The real threat is enforcement of existing law. He says the law is not changing. Health freedom is not the issue. The issue is that the UK homeopathic medicine manufacturers have chosen not to register most of their products. The reasons aren't important. If they had registered more of their products, the problem would be largely mitigated. The petitions are pointless, which I kind of agree too, because they fail to address, not because they fail to address the root cause. That's what he says, because they do fail to address the root cause. The UK legislation of homeopathic medicines is the result of EU, European Union directives that are the result of heavy lobbying by European manufacturers. These directives suit them very well as the medical homeopaths, as opposed to the lay homeopaths. There has been plenty of time to deal with these issues, but why is the UK homeopathic leadership never doing anything proactively? And this is really kind of a mishmash of an answer to me that he's saying it's due to the homeopathic manufacturers, where this doesn't seem to be true in my mind. Could you make sense of what he is saying?
Well, I got at least the part of it that sounded like there were, because you talked about, I think you said licensed remedies,
right,
versus non-licensed remedies. And so it raises a question that I don't, have information about: what constitutes licensing? How do you get that or not get that? Or would,
right,
this current issue restrict homeopathic manufacturers' ability to license? Are they limited only to those 100? Is it an issue, just a question of going through some procedure to get licensing, and then the other remedies would be readily available too? you know, it raises those kinds of questions, and it's hard to say. It raises to maybe more generalize the issue as well, too. It's often times that I see people with the best of intentions either misunderstanding or misframing an issue, and so it certainly is clouding the issue in my mind with that response and without having information.
Right. We really don't, you know, we don't have the details as to what he's implying here. But there are probably many reasons why there are only 100 licensed remedies that we don't know the answers to those questions. And he's also pitting the medical homeopaths who have maybe MD degrees against those who are practicing homeopaths with certifications and lay homeopaths who are caring for the country folk, you know? And this has been a tradition for eons. So why can't people care for family and friends? So
why can't they continue the tradition they've been doing, you know,
right,
especially with something that has the track record of both success and lack of harm that homeopathy does? And so regardless of the answer to those kind of detailed questions, I think you really hit it on the head right there, Debbie, that the concern, you know, it comes to this fundamental freedom issue, which, of course, is what we're always talking about in one form or another with vaccine discussions as well. When, you know, should we have or do we have, and can we create if we don't have and sustain if we do have, the right to determine how to treat our health issues and health problems, what goes into our bodies, and should that be something that could be controlled, and if so, in what way and to what degree, by outside interests. And as Robert Scott Bell, at least where I first heard it, Natural News radio show host, put it, we need to have separation of, I think he said, separation of vaccine and state was the way he put it, or something very similar to that with regard to the vaccine issue. But we really need, you know, the separation of church and state needs to apply to, or that concept, the separation. There needs to be a separation of government and any and all industry. What we've seen here in the U.S. is essentially a takeover of the government by the healthcare industry as it pertains to healthcare issues, and I'm sure other industries for other issues as well. And I think this is at least one aspect of what we're talking about with homeopathy in the U.K. Is this something, you know, is the pharmaceutical industry ultimately going to be allowed to usurp any and everything else? It certainly has tried to do that for many decades in the U.S. and has achieved a disturbing level of success with that, success in the sense of limiting our access to other choices, success from their point of view, not success from the point of view of health and liberty of individuals.
Right, and you know, in the U.K., that is really a hot spot for health freedom because they've already lost their access to herbs. So if Ellen was saying, if somebody wanted to get Avena sativa, just a regular calming herb, they're unable to get it and they have to call her. So because she does have a dispensing license. So that's very frightening to see step by step. They're just cutting down the ability of people, citizens, to access what has always been traditionally there. You know, folk medicine in England has probably gone for many generations back.
Well, I share what I think I understood you to say, your opinion generally about petitions, do they really help or not? But I think petitions are a place, at least in some instances, where people can voice their opinions and where others can see the number of people who feel strongly enough about something to speak out for or against it in that way. And I also agree, Debbie, that it's helpful for people outside of the country to express an opinion as well, in that it lets people know that this is not a local issue, that there is an international eye watching what goes on. And even though, and of course, you know, we have the similar sort of thing here in the U.S. where if there's a legislative issue, it's not, if it's a state level issue, it's not necessarily all that helpful for somebody out of state to contact, you know, a state representative to express an opinion. But I think there's some value in that, in at least insofar as it lets legislators dealing with a state issue, state legislators, know that there's a national eye watching what they're doing. And there were speakers, for example, recently in Vermont, talking to the Vermont representatives, doing formal presentations from outside of Vermont. I know Mary Holland, a law professor at New York University, spoke, I spoke, and of course many people from right inside of Vermont. But they do sometimes hear and pay attention to that. And so I think there is some benefit for doing that. So don't be too quick to say, well, I'm not in the UK, so I don't really care. Even when it's a local issue, there are often international implications. And it's good to let folks know that the people in the rest of the world care about what's going on and are watching it.
Okay, let's move on to the next issue that you have up for grabs here.
Okay, I'm going to start off here, which is going to sound like a completely unrelated issue to vaccines, and it is, but I just wanted to point out briefly, I guess it's sort of a good news, bad news story here. I've got a I get regular emails, broadcast emails from my state representatives here in North Carolina, and got one from my state senator. And she says, many concerned citizens from all over the state joined legislators in a press conference to announce a resolution. And this is in the state of North Carolina, asking federal Congress to pass an amendment to the Constitution that would, in effect, overturn a Supreme Court ruling a little while back, Citizens United. It was the name of that case. And my representative, both of my representatives, my state senator and my state House representative, will be introducing that resolution here in North Carolina this week. The Citizens United decision, which many people were outraged about, and even the president in his State of the Union address criticized, is a decision that allows corporations to spend unlimited money for a candidate as long as there's no coordination between the so-called super PAC and the candidate. Corporations in this country, for many legal purposes, are considered to be persons, and I find that in and of itself a disturbing concept.
Have they confirmed that?
I believe this Citizens United, well, that's what they did was to validate that in a particular way in regard to corporations' ability to spend money supporting candidates. And what it boils down to, I think, in one sense, is simply that, I mean, we already knew this to one degree or another, that corporations run the country and so forth, but what this has done is just sort of brought that out in the open and made it, you know, even more official that corporations can spend as much money as they want to on candidates. Well, basically, if you want to run, especially for federal office, but even state office, if you've got the money backing you, you've got the best chance of winning. And if you don't have money backing you, you're probably going to lose. And that's just the practical reality. And it really, that reality just sort of flies in the face of the fundamental concepts and intentions behind democracies generally in our democratic republic. If you have to have money to get elected, then you're not really representing your constituency. You're representing a very limited number of people who funded your campaign. Whether, regardless of what you say or do, and it would be very difficult for any reasonable person to not be influenced, even if subconsciously, in favor of those who got them into office. And in many cases, it seems to be rather, not only is it not subconscious, it's rather blatant. But in any event, I thought that this basic concept was really good, that my representatives are supporting a resolution asking Congress to pass an amendment that would overturn this Supreme Court decision. Let's rein in this now unlimited ability of corporations to determining the outcomes of elections.
What is this bill? You're mentioning a bill?
Not a bill.
Not a bill. What is it?
It's a resolution.
Okay.
Asking Congress to pass an amendment to the Constitution that would, in effect, overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. This, I think, is a very good thing. We talk about over and over on this show about how corporations run the government and not really the people who the government theoretically and hypothetically are representing. No longer are we a nation where we rule ourselves. We're a nation where we have the pretense of ruling ourselves, but who really determines much of what goes on, if not most of what goes on, are corporations, representing the special interests of a very limited number of wealthy people who have the money to influence and control government. And the result of that is many things that are not really supportive of the people and individual rights and freedoms, but rather directly contrary to that. And that gets us, of course, the whole vaccine issue is one dramatic ongoing example of that, and just one of many, I'm sure. What I had issue with, and why I mentioned this, because Citizens United doesn't really have anything to do with vaccines in a direct way, is that I was really disturbed in what seemed the profound hypocrisy of my representatives in North Carolina seeking to control corporations' unlimited ability to spend money influencing campaigns. When I went to each of these representatives with a detailed legal memorandum complaining about a law we have here in North Carolina that allows minors to consent to vaccines and other medical treatments of any age. You know, your two-year-old in daycare can say, yes, I would like a vaccine, please, or other medical treatment. In blatant violation of parents' constitutional rights to make those decisions for their children, in direct and blatant contradiction to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that says that children, even adolescents, can't make medical decisions for themselves. Parents have to do that. And, in fact, this particular law, in my assessment, violates four state and federal constitutional provisions and, additionally, four state and federal statutory provisions. It's really a bad law, and the pretense under which it was passed was for issues that are already addressed by other North Carolina law. So the whole thing, to me, appears to be either serious oversight or deliberate scam, but whichever it is, it's really, really bad law. And I took that law to my state senator and said, you know, can you help me get this fixed? And her response was, oh, I can't help you with this because we have UNC hospitals in our district. So she thinks it's okay to criticize the federal government for allowing corporations to run the country, essentially, to pick the leaders. But we can't change the laws, bad law here in North Carolina. She didn't disagree with me that it was unconstitutional. And like every representative at the state and federal level, she took an oath to uphold the Constitution. She didn't disagree that it was unconstitutional law. She just said, oh, well, we can't deal with that because UNC Hospitals is in our district. As though it's a foregone conclusion, for one thing, that UNC Hospitals, if the attention were brought to them, would oppose fixing the law.
Can you clarify what does the UNC Hospitals have to do with the law?
It's a health care law. It allows children to consent to health care.
Okay, so what does that have to do with the hospitals?
Well, you'd have to ask my representative. I assume what she means is because this is a law that gives medical people access to children by bypassing parents, that they
if a child is in an emergency situation, dire need, and needs to be rushed to the hospital, and needs a limb, you know, they broke a bone or something really drastic, and they need to resuscitate, then they're going to rush the child to the hospital and take care of this child, whether or not they have the parent's consent.
They already have that authority under other law to treat children in emergency, but it's not because the child can consent. It's because the doctor has authority to intervene in an emergency.
Okay.
And, you know, my point of view on this is that you don't ever need to give children authority to consent to their own health care. If there's an emergency, doctors already have that authority. If there's abuse or neglect, DSS can step in and assume temporary custody, and they can make the decision for the child to get medical treatment. But you don't ever have a situation where a child has to consent. If there's a situation that requires immediate attention, and you don't have time to contact a parent, or part of the reason for this law had to do with abused children, where you might not even have a healthy parent there to contact, even if you do have time.
Okay.
But those are situations, if it's a medical emergency, there's already authority for the medical professional to intervene. If it's a non-medical emergency, something, again, involving abuse or whatever, then the state has authority to step in and assume temporary, if need be, or even, but on the spot, can assume temporary custody, and then they can grant authority for a child to be treated. If there's some non-emergency need, but still a compelling need. So, or some reason that the parent can't be contacted or make the decision, or the parent's not a
person. So there are already laws on the books to cover all of those events and circumstances, situations.
Yeah, so the two representatives who are all for getting corporations out of the federal system are saying they don't want to do anything about this law, well, my state senator in particular, because of corporate health care. So it's okay for the corporations to run the laws here in North Carolina. It's just not okay at the federal level. And I find that, rather blatantly hypocritical. And I'm increasingly, I was very polite with my senator when she said she couldn't help me and I left. And I'm glad I was polite. That was the professional thing to do. But I have become increasingly angry since leaving that meeting because this woman took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And her advice to me was, go see this other guy at another, one of her colleagues, a Republican colleague. He's into that constitutional stuff. So it's okay for you then, Senator Kennard, to take an oath to uphold the Constitution, but that doesn't really mean anything in the real world. You're going to do whatever you want to because of what the local corporation tells you to do or what you think they want to do.
Because do you think she feels unempowered? Because if she doesn't do what she's doing, then the people who support her will kick her out of office?
You know, we can only speculate. I mean, that's a reasonable speculation, but it's speculation nonetheless. I understand that the world is run by politics and not by truth and science and the things and integrity, the things that we feel like it should and that it pretends on its surface or face to be run by. But this was such a glaring example.
Can I interrupt and ask you another kind of a question? Okay,
sure.
So let's say, I don't care who the representative, senator, House of Representatives, whoever they are, if they have things that they're really concerned about, issues they're really concerned about, and they know that they have to compromise on one thing or another in order to, let's say, help kids who are abused, or they love pets and they're into the pet protection, or whether education, whatever their thing is. But on the other hand, on the other side, there are things that they know that in order to stay in their position, in order to put forth some good stuff, they also have to abide by and compromise some of their things. Do you understand my question?
Sure. Appropriate compromise means you get some of what you want, but not all, and I get some of what I want, but not all.
Okay.
That is a fact of life in the political arena, and should be reasonably should be in democratic society, where there's going to be people with different wants, different needs, different viewpoints, different opinions, and in law. They have this phrase, reasonable people may disagree. And there certainly is no end to the number of issues on which reasonable people may disagree. And that necessarily, in many instances, means that if there's any sort of practical resolution that to go forward on with, it's going to be compromised. But there are certain fundamental walls or lines that cannot be compromised or should not be compromised. And you do not pass a law that supports increased profit of an industry to the detriment of fundamental constitutional rights. When you take an oath as a representative to uphold the Constitution, that means, in practical terms, that if you become aware that a bill or a law violates constitutional boundaries, then you cannot, with any honesty or integrity, support that. And if you see a problem in a law that's already been passed, then you would be obligated at that point to fix it. Now, you know, I can go in there and say, look at all these different conflicts and problems. Let's, you know, repeal the whole law. And maybe a representative would say, well, Alan, that's going too far. Why don't we compromise? Let's see if we can fix the constitutional boundary. Let's change the language so that we're not violating the Constitution, but let's keep this law in there. I mean, if the purpose for which this law was passed is something that's covered by other law, that's an argument for repeal. But in the real world, the other law appeared not to be working for some people in some issues or some situations. So maybe some redundancy in law would not be a bad thing if it fixes a problem.
Uh-huh.
But to do that, to cause harm in order to fix harm,
right?
You know, doesn't
it's
make
like
sense.
It's like stealing to pay somebody, then it's dirty money
exactly.
No matter what.
Exactly. And with this particular issue, perhaps if appropriate or desired, we could come back and look at this in more detail in the future. But if the issue here presumably was about making sure that children, certain kinds of abusive situations, children could get treatment, well, if that's really what the law is about, then let's have the law refer to those specific situations and not just sweepingly pull parental rights from every parent in the state. And the Supreme Court has addressed that issue right on the head and has said you cannot take away the rights of all parents in a state in order to try to deal with a problem that affects a tiny minority of parents. Yes, abuse exists and happens, and it's horrible, it's awful. The only 4.0 I got in my 3 years of law school was in a class where my entire grade came from a research paper that I did on child abuse. I am very critically aware of child abuse issues, of problems in the system, where in some instances children get taken from a home when they shouldn't be, and in instances where children should be taken from a home and they aren't, and they suffer abuse or even occasionally death because of a failure in the system. There are, you know, problems that need to be addressed in the system. And I'm all for finding solutions to these problems. No, you know, child should ever have to suffer abuse. So let's end that. And those who are victims, let's give them any treatment and care they need as quickly and efficiently and effectively as possible. But that's not something, a problem that needs to be fixed by taking away all parents' rights in the state. So I just am very skeptical that the law was really written to cover the issues that my representatives are telling me it was intended to cover. I think that was a pretext or a pretense for writing sweeping language that gives medical authorities the ability to bypass parents for a long
right.
list of things, including all vaccines.
Right.
So we need to fix the issue. So I'm, you know, long-winded way here of saying I really like the idea of a resolution and ultimately an amendment to the Constitution that fixes the Citizens United Supreme Court problem, that decision. But I want to see my representative step up to the plate and support constitutional rights right here in North Carolina. And let's get rid of that hypocrisy then. If you're gonna want to get corporations out of the federal government, let's get it out of the state government as well.
Well, that was, you know, it was an introduction to an off-topic, but really not, because we covered so many important issues that do deal with health care, health freedom, health rights, who is in power, who is in charge, how we can we make a difference in this case? Do we need to call our representatives now to ask them to do something about overturning this resolution? People actually need to learn how to act, and that would be a good focus of this program, just enabling people to be able to speak out by teaching them what they can do.
Well, I would say if you're in North Carolina, contact your representatives and say that you support this resolution from North Carolina to the federal Congress, asking for an amendment to our federal constitution that would overturn, in effect, again, this Citizens United. And this is in one way or another, the courts and the legislatures go back and forth on things. You know, if courts interpret current law in such a way that the legislature or the people, presumably by way of their legislative representatives, disagree with and don't like, then the legislature can enact laws to deal with that. There is an additional deeper step that can happen, and that is an amendment to Constitution, which can happen at the state or federal level. But the point is that legislatures are empowered to, I keep saying overrule, and that's really not an accurate term, but in effect, they can, in effect, overrule the courts. If the courts interpret law being a certain way and the legislature doesn't like it, then they can pass law to change that.
The states can overrule the courts, did you say? The who?
A state legislature can overrule, in effect, the state court's formal legal precedent, formal opinions. Usually we're referring to opinions that would be coming from state appellate courts. The federal legislature can, in effect, overrule the federal courts, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had this ruling in Citizens United that allows corporations to spend unlimited money on candidates. And Congress could pass a law if it wanted to, saying placing limits, saying, you know, corporations can only spend this much, or you know, putting some sort of barrier or limit on that. The resolution that my state representatives are seeking is one that's asking for an amendment to the federal constitution, which is also another possible response to this, although it's a more difficult one, I think, to achieve.
How likely is it now? The North Carolina courts are doing this action. Can other states and citizens around the United States become involved in voicing their opinion to make a difference?
People anywhere in the country can contact their federal representatives to say, we support an amendment to the Constitution, or we support legislation that would, again, in effect, reverse the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So that is something people can do. People in North Carolina could contact their state representatives and saying, hey, please support this North Carolina resolution. Asking, it's a state legislative resolution that will be asking the Congress, federal Congress, to actually amend the U.S. Constitution, if I understand this correctly. So,
well, you know, I asked you to repeat the same thing about five different times in five different ways, and I think it's really important to do that just so that people can understand what's going on in the complexity of the law and the complexity of local, state, and federal government, to know where they stand, what they can do, what actions they can take. They can call, they can pick up the phone and call their representative. Now, is this in the Senate?
Well, at this particular point, And I understand, and I think it is important because it's a, I've explained this, and yet it's a little tricky because we're talking about an end goal of an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but we're talking about a state senator and a state representative in North Carolina who are taking a step to put together a resolution. Now, if I understand this correctly, and there's always a possibility that I'm not clearly on board with all of this either, but I'll give you my best understanding. This would be a resolution from the North Carolina legislature, presumably as such representing the citizens of North Carolina.
Okay.
Asking the federal Congress to amend the Constitution. Now, the federal Congress could deal with the Supreme Court decision if the federal Congress doesn't like the result. The federal Congress could pass legislation, could pass statutes, laws that put limits on what corporations can do in terms of contributing to or financing political candidates. But it seems to me like what this resolution from North Carolina will be asking for is not for legislation, but actually an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Once the Constitution is amended, that would prevent any future legislation, theoretically, that might open that door again.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
People would say, well, what's the difference in passing a law or amending the Constitution? And on a practical level, I'm not entirely sure, but on the theoretical level, if you have an amendment to the Constitution, see, what you can do with legislation is theoretically limited by the framework of the Constitution. But we see that in reality is not what happens at the state level or the federal level. You know, we had this law passed recently that allowed for the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists. That's a violation of fundamental constitutional rights. Theoretically, that law could not be passed because it violates due process, which is part of the U.S. Constitution. But the law got passed anyway. And we've talked about in the vaccine arena how Washington State passed a law last year that unconstitutionally restricts access to religious exemptions. And California is considering a bill to do that right now. And about how North Carolina has a law that allows children to consent to vaccines. That's unconstitutional. We have a law that was just passed in California that lets 12-year-olds and up consent to HPV and hepatitis B vaccines. That's unconstitutional. We have, or it may even be, I'm not sure, now exactly, it was at least the HPV vaccine. And then a bill in New York pending now that if passed would allow at least some minors access to HPV and hepatitis B vaccines. I think that's where I was remembering those two together as a pair, is in the New York bill. And the bottom line is legislatures can pass laws whether they're constitutional or not. And if we think a law that gets passed and is on the books now is unconstitutional, then we potentially, if we meet the right conditions for what's called standing, can challenge that in court. And we can certainly go back to our representatives and say, this law's not appropriate. You know, it violates the Constitution. This needs to be amended or repealed. So the real world is real different from the theoretical world. And it raises the question, why are they asking for an amendment to the Constitution? Why aren't they just asking for legislation, which is an easier goal to achieve? The Constitution was designed so that it could be amended, and it necessarily should have been, because our forefathers knew that societies evolve and there would be changing needs. And so, of course, the Constitution needs to be a living, breathing document that can adapt as need be, but it also needs to be something that cannot just be changed whimsically. So I can't spell the details off the top of my head, but it takes it's a much more challenging goal to amend the Constitution than it is to get legislation passed. But either one of them are potential solutions to the problem.
I just got a news flash in. It says, you know, North Carolina, that's our state, passed an amendment that barred same-sex marriage. So it says a U.S. judge has struck down a 1996 federal law barring gays and lesbians from receiving federal benefits. This is May 29, 2012 news. The latest in a series of court decisions pushing this issue of same-sex marriage closer to a Supreme Court reckoning. I'm not exactly sure, but the message that I got was that the judge is going to overturn what we have just voted on. And I'm not sure whether this is true or false, but that's the news coming in. So,
well, it's an interesting point. The case you just reported is certainly a related issue, but not the exact same, precisely, you know, same issue or language in of the amendment that was just passed. And I had the very same question in my mind when this amendment was passed here in North Carolina. Is it constitutional? Would it would it withstand constitutional scrutiny? In other words, if somebody challenged this in court, if you can do that with a constitutional amendment, you know, would it withstand scrutiny? So it's an interesting question, and we'll just have to see how
Here's
things play
out. Here's
another
one: gay marriage ban challenged in Illinois. This comes out today, published May 30th, 2012. Less than a month after President Obama endorsed gay marriage, two dozen same-sex couples filed two separate lawsuits in the president's home state on Wednesday, arguing that it is unconstitutional for Illinois to deny them the right to wed. So I'm glad to hear that people are taking steps to speak out. I mean, they're putting their lives on the line, aren't they, to do these kinds of outspoken, stand up for my rights kind of thing.
Well, potentially, because disturbingly there are people who feel strongly enough about issues in this country, some issues that they're willing to kill for it, such as the, you know, abortion issues and racial issues over the decades, of course, and probably this one as well.
Yeah, I didn't mean just their life on the line for that reason. I meant that they
literally
they put their life on hold in order to pursue this kind of change in legislation, because once they get involved, that's the only thing that they're doing. You know, they're not going to work. They're not caring for their family. They're in the limelight, having to be, you know, interrogated or whatever, or defend
themselves.
Well,
it is all consuming on more than one level. But yes, and oftentimes the people who go after issues on principle, in effect, sacrifice a good portion of their life so that others may benefit. I mean, you read the story about our founding fathers, where they were on the run. Many of them ultimately were found and killed. Others, you know, lost their farms and wealth and so forth because of having taken a stand against Britain and you know, fighting for a new country and a new cause and liberty and so forth. And we don't hear the, you know, we hear how great and wonderful they were. We don't often hear the story of how their individual lives played out. And I read something about that recently, which was quite insightful to me, about how difficult their lives actually ultimately became. They may or may not have had some level of anticipation or expectation of that, but either whether they did or not, that's what their lives many of their lives ended up being. And to set up a society and system where those who followed them could have something much less troubling than what they went through to get it for us. And that's what we'll see. But, I mean, that's what we saw. And that seems to be par for the course for many people who decide to fully take on a liberty cause.
To be a leader. To you know, like if you're going through a forest, hacking away at the brush and clearing the way for the people who follow you. So we covered a lot of very informative details about both the UK situation on the United States and state situations here about the law, amendments, resolutions, the Constitution. We covered the gamut. And if there is any other specific thing that you want to mention today about vaccine rights or something else,
well,
let's talk about it.
we're about at the end of the time today. I tell you what, let's make a point next time around. I think it's good to have these kinds of discussions because the framework within which all of the vaccine issues sit is a state, national, and international law and politics that provides the setting in which all this goes on. And the vaccine issue is not by any means separate from the other big health and health freedom issues that are playing out in societies locally and nationally and internationally around the world today as well. So I think it was good for us to take that. But we'll come back on a little more directly on focus with vaccines specifically in the next show. But in the meantime, I want to remind people about the ebook that's available, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, that I've written to give people the information they need to make informed vaccine decisions, including how the laws and rights vary from place to place and context to context, and what parts of the law apply across the board, as some do. And if you're making your vaccine exemption decisions in an informed way, you have a much better chance of success and a much lower chance of inadvertently shooting yourself in the foot, which can happen in some exemption and waiver context. You can link to that from Homeopathy World Community and encourage folks to do that, because that link will take you to the ebook at the vaccinerights.com website. But in doing so, if you do in fact decide to purchase the ebook, you support both Homeopathy World Community and the work I do with Vaccine Rights. And Debbie and I both put in a tremendous amount of volunteer time for our respective and overlapping concerns and causes, trying to help you understand and better exercise and attain, if as an appropriate and needed, the right to make informed healthcare choices and decisions for you and your family. And we're
right,
here to support you in doing that.
You are a great support. And I'll let folks know how they can find the links. It's going to take a couple of clicks. If you go to homeopathyworldcommunity.com, you're going to see a little picture of Alan on the right-hand column. It says Alan Phillips, Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., Thursday at noon. And when you click that, you're going to get to the group where we house many of our shows. And there is a little picture that says, ask about vaccine legal exemptions. It's right under the quote that says, life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. Albert Einstein. And so right under that is a little button. And if you click it, that will take you directly to the page to take a look at the e-guide. I also want to let folks know that Alan, besides being a very good friend and an excellent lawyer, he's one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys who advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States about vaccine exemption and waiver rights. Besides being a great legislative author of initiatives, he also publishes on Natural News with Mike Adams and has done many, many other radio shows. I don't know how many you do a week, but I know you do a lot. So we're going to close the show in a minute today, and just also want to let folks know that we have the next show coming up. I don't know if we're going to talk to Greg next week, Greg Glaser, a constitutional lawyer. What do you say?
He'll be with us probably next week or the week after. We'll have to get in touch with him and see what works schedule-wise, but he will be back with us, and he's not to miss, folks. So we hope you'll
stay
great.
Tuned.
Yep.
And then just for your information, we're going to have on Monday at 11 on the Health In Show, which is a live video podcast, we're going to have a talk about the 10 top reasons why women get migraines. And that should be interesting. After that, the following week, it's going to be the top 10 reasons why men get migraines. So if you know anybody who gets headaches from too much banging their head against the wall for these legal issues, that might be a reason. And on Wednesday, we're going to have Dr. Adel talking about the rubrics in the chest chapter from homeopathy and learn about what kind of remedies can help you when you have symptoms in the organs of the torso, the ribs, the lungs, the heart, the mammae, the stomach, all of that. And before Alan on Thursday, we also talk with Dr. Christina Shambro about pet health, and we've been talking about pet behavior. So I'm going to end the show, and I want to thank you again, Alan, for always being here every week.
And you as well, Debbie.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth be young girl, one by one.